This is Unscripted, a mental health podcast from Schoen Clinic Mental Health Specialists.
Should I introduce myself?
Hi, Joe. I'm Emma, as you know. I'm a family psychotherapist, but I'm a social worker. I've got some additional trainings in nonviolent resistance, NVR, EMDR, and I also practice a little bit DBT, Joe. I was born in the Midlands in Stoke-on-Trent, so I'm just connected. And you let me know where you're from, but I'll let you say that. Got quite a working class background, Joe. I went to university and I think I was the first of my family to go to university. And that's quite difficult. And then sort of from there, I sort of grasped onto education, which can be difficult if you haven't got the finances behind you or even parental support. And just kept moving forward. I trained as a social worker, which I absolutely loved. And I worked in adult mental health. And then I worked in the famous systemic model over in East London as a family therapist. But I guess what I am at heart is that girl from Stoke, still thinking about where I fit in the world, still checking my accent, wondering if I make sense with my own sort of ideas of knowledges and privileges. Well, that's me, Joe.
So I'm Dr. Joe Datt. I'm a consultant child and adolescent paediatrician, and I was born in the West Midlands in Birmingham. Most of my childhood was in the early years was in the West Midlands, though I did do a short stint in the US and then came back to Midlands. Same again as Emma, very much working family background. Later on, left to pursue my career in various degrees that I had done. Initially started with biochemistry and drug design, and then went to the US to do postgraduate studies and start a PhD, and then was working at the National Institute of Health for Cancer in Bethesda, Maryland, and then came back and have worked in drug research and clinical research, which is where my sort of background stems from, rare diseases and clinical research, and then decided later on in life to do medicine and then specialize in pediatrics. And then that was the first time when I went back to the Midlands to do all my training. And then I've worked since then in Australia, at US, in Boston and San Francisco, and then find myself in London. So wide variety of experience from clinical research to working with patients and children. But yes, and we are connections, Emma, of within the Midlands of Birmingham and Stoke.
Amazing how we make those connections. That's so fascinating. Just going towards the more sort of nitty-gritty parts of our work, and I can hear that you open up possibilities, you're bringing in alternative voices, you're not just going on a diagnostic path, so I love working with you, but how do you get families, Joe, how do you work with them through the trenches? We see a lot of families, I think, they're really stuck in those trenches, and they've been in there a while. And it could be because school is difficult, family is difficult, parental issues going on. Life is difficult, sure. How do you stick with that, Joe, and keep that hope alive?
I think one of the ways in which I do is to take things back to basics. One of the things here at the clinic I do is if there are some behaviour issues or difficulties at school, teachers are presenting but they're not seeing it at home, or vice versa, is to really, what I do here is a neurodevelopmental assessment, which includes really taking the history from birth right up until the age that I'm seeing them, whether it's 13, 14, or even as young as 6 or 7. And I look at all the milestones to look at, is there anything that may have been picked up in those early years? And really, for this allows the parents to actually, the feedback I get sometimes is, oh, it's the first time someone's actually ever gone through the whole history of my child. Right from pregnancy as well, looking at what the pregnancy was like, what was the, were there any problems down to delivery? And then the subsequent years after that. So that sort of wider angle of looking at the child from those early years to where they are now, were there any red flags in those early years? Did they miss milestones? Were there support areas that are being missed? Unfortunately, these things do happen, whether it's the NHS or privately, sometimes things are missed. And as new parents, they may not always know, ah, this was missed, this was a milestone that's missed, unless it's something that's really significant, like walking. If someone misses their milestones for walking, they'll go and seek help. because there may be other subtle milestones that they may have been delayed on. And so some of these things may present with other difficulties. So just recently I had an eight-year-old boy who I saw, and the parents were concerned because they said the child's not achieving. The school said he's not achieving, but they didn't really know where else to go. And by doing this neurodevelopmental assessment, I was really to look at all the milestones. And when I looked at some of those, they were significantly dropping off when they were about four or five. And unfortunately, it wasn't picked up. And now this child is eight and is still struggling. And so some of these assessments, when you're going through the full history and then picking up some of these things, like a global developmental delay or a learning disability, picking them up early and then putting in steps to implement and support them. So whether it's speech and language therapy, occupational therapy, or even as a paediatrician, to bring their care together in the wider team and bringing all those things. And then sometimes it's doing investigations, whether it's blood tests, genetics. If the child has maybe some learning disability or global developmental delay, it's always worth looking at doing some genetics to see, is there any genetic area that may be a cause of why they might be behind in their milestones. And I think some of these things really help for myself and also the parents and also the child to actually, these are the issues that may be missed. And so really the feedback I usually get for the parents is it's the first time someone's actually ever gone through that full history of the child, and it allows an overall view of what steps I needed, what assessments are needed, what investigations are needed, and then also breaking down some easy, simple steps like breaking information down, giving visual aids to the children if they're struggling, if they've got some form of learning disability, not just expecting them to giving them a verbal instruction, but writing things down, star charts and other factors like that, so the child can actually see some visual elements so that they process that information.
You make me smile, Joe, because I guess, you know, the question was about how we sit through the trenches, and you know, that's difficult. We're in the territory sometimes of the unknowns, and we have to sit there for a while before we can get to the knowns. But it sounds like you're forever problem solving and looking for what might help that child, that mom, that dad on that day, and then going forward the next day.
Yeah.
That's such a building of both knowledge in them, but also it sounds like you really use yourself, Joe, who you are as a therapist, as a doctor, to sort of bring that relationship on and make that stronger too. Am I hearing you right?
Yeah, I think so. I think when they're coming to you, they're seeking help.
Yeah.
Sometimes they don't know. They're not sure what's going on. And so by going through that history, explaining what it means and why I'm asking these questions, and then not just myself, but the wider team. So, you know, whether it's input from a speech and language therapist, input from therapists, psychologists, psychotherapists, and really signposting to parents saying, look, you may benefit by speaking to this psychologist, this psychotherapist, to really support the needs of that child. I think here at the clinic, it really helps when you've got that team or that multidisciplinary team to, it's not just a sort of one fit shop. We've got a good mix of clinicians, therapists, to really help some of those children, but and also the parents.
Once again, Joe, this is heartening. I guess for me, as we work systemically, it means that we work with who we are in collaboration with, whether that's other agencies, whether that's other family members, whether it's school, but more importantly, it's our colleagues. What skills, knowledges, experiences do our colleagues have that can supplement my own, that could bring difference to this family that's been in the trenches for a long time? And it sounds like you're attuned to other people's knowledges and skills, and that you want to bring them on board to help families.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think we probably feel very similar in terms of those things of, if we want to help the patients, not only just the patients, the wider network of the patients, the family, the carers. And if we can't offer something ourselves, we've got colleagues and the network of people that we may know as well, and experience that we bring to possibly offer solutions, and then present that to the parents or the child, and for them to go away, think about what they want to do, knowing that there is a team out there, not just only at the clinic, but also in the wider field, that these are good experts here that can really share their knowledge. And ultimately, it's about sharing knowledge. And I guess videos like this or podcasts like this really help bring that information out there for parents, carers, patients as well to understand and think, right, okay, that really makes sense. And maybe I'm going to go and speak to someone that I think that really resonates with them.
Yeah. Because I guess, you know, when you're working with children, children are part of a network, part of context, part of a structure. And so what we need to be doing is working with the school, at least in the provision of information or having some contact with them, passing on some knowledges, skilling them up too. And in order to provide that sort of more safety net, we need to be working with our colleagues everywhere, but also that wider family too.
I think you touched on a point there with schools, Emily. It's something that I always advocate is who I say to the parents when I give any sort of diagnosis or recommendations, I put recommendations for the school and also offer to speak to the schools, whether it's Senko or the class teacher, to elicit some more information and also solutions to how they can help that child. Do you ever get many sort of teachers who want to come and speak to you and say, what can I do? What tangible solutions and recommendations?
I do, Joe, and I absolutely love it.
Yeah,
I think there's nothing more heartening than having a really good conversation with another professional. And when that conversation is designed to be helping a family who are feeling vulnerable, in need, or a child who's in distress, I think we can come up with great things. I'm working with a school at the moment and actually using the principles of MBR in that school in order that there is consistency around that child, that mom and dad are practicing these MBR techniques, not escalating and whatnot, but also that school are knowing that they need to connect with that child before they go into correction. And so there is a consistency and there is a nice sort of a network around that child that's probably providing lots of safety. And then that safety in the network also makes those parents feel a little bit better. There's decreased phone calls from school saying, sorry, your child's just done this, or your child hasn't revised, so therefore we're doing this. And then school start to feel more competent as well, because they find that they're not always having to tell that child off. So I think that bringing that network together, the sharing of information and the utilising of other people's skills, knowledges, techniques, experiences, is all about helping that child, isn't it?
Yeah. I think you touched on a really valid point, and I think maybe it's something that maybe the clinic should maybe think about offering schools some kind of MBR or even a workshop for teachers to come and really understand, because if it's not affecting one child in their class, there's probably many children. And I think those kind of tools that you're saying, giving the teachers to take control, have the tools necessary to communicate, problem solve with those children, rather than kind of ringing the parents and saying, I've got a problem, come and collect your child. You're, you know, really dealing with the issue there so that it doesn't then escalate.
Yeah.
Which may be something that we could work on together with the teachers.
Be helpful, Joe.
Yeah.
Joe, can I ask you a couple of questions where sometimes I can get a bit stuck, because obviously I live in this complex society and sometimes I don't know what to do. And I think one of the big issues right now for children I see is phone use. And I'm just wondering what your take on this. I don't expect you to have solutions, Joe. I don't think there is one solution to the problem we're facing around phone use. But there's something that crops up with me every day of my working life. Same with you.
Yeah, phones are, I guess there's multiple ways of what people use phones or screens. And people go, are all screens bad? And in actual fact, no. Not all screens are bad. Some screens, depending on how often you're on it, especially during COVID time, all homework was on screens, whether it was tablets, iPads, etc. And some parents nowadays will give the child a phone to contact them or send them a message, and they've got that access there. And some schools have a no phones policy where they'll say, drop all your phones here. And so I think finding a happy medium is the best solution. I do see a lot of children, whether they come into clinic and the first thing they do, it's they've got an iPad, a phone, and then even at home, it's screen to screen. So iPad, phone, TV. There are positives to screens in that it's a knowledge base and it's learning. but then the perils of having phone with no restrictions on, and I think it's really important that restrictions are put in place. Some parents will say, oh yeah, I've got restrictions, but actually have they got a restriction? Because before you know it, their child might be at a very young age looking at various things, that there's banners, ads, and things that are showing that probably are more adult content than children. So I think the screens in itself, whether it's gaming and things, can offer some skills that improve their things like manual dexterity in gaming. But also, you don't want to be on a screen for, you know, 8, 10, 12 hours. So pulling the child away from the screen is also important, and having breaks. A few recent books that have come out about screens and screen time and what is the optimum, but it does still say that not all screens are bad, but it's really up to parents to decide how often there is. There is no hard and fast rule. What I do encourage is at least 2 hours before sleep, avoiding screen time, because the blue light and things like that can really impact sleep if sleep is already an issue. And then making sure that you don't, if they do wake up in the middle of the night, there's sleep disorders, they're not picking, the first thing they do is pick up the phone. And I find that not only just with children, with adults as well, is the first thing they do nowadays is pick up the phone.
Yes.
And every sort of break time or things that they have, it's the first thing they'll do is pick up the phone, which might be an alien few years ago. And you think maybe in the past where you'd be like carrying a phone around all the time. No one would think about carrying a home phone around ever. It's the same with employers, I think, as well. You're almost always in contact. And having screen break time is really important as well. That includes all of us, children and adults.
I'd agree, Joe. Myself included, many times I'm wondering about a child's phone use whilst also using mine to a detrimental level. I totally agree. I mean, what I would say from sort of family therapy perspective there is, some little hints and tips, I guess, is try and connect with your child outside of the phone. Are there hobbies, interests, activities that, you know, you've just let pass you by because the phone's got in the way? As you say, we were all using them during COVID. I think it's really helpful when they're negotiating phone use in children, especially teenagers, Joe, that we try and refrain from some patterns that become unhelpful, shouting and criticism. What I find from my experience in working with families is when that's present, the problem isn't being resolved, and that teenager tends to start feeling very criticised and start to withdraw a little bit more with more phone use. Try and negotiate with your teenager. Try and have open conversations. Let them know, actually, that you are worried about this over use of the phone. And then, you know, use those skills you've got as a parent to try and bring back some of those things you're missing between you and your teenager. Connecting with them through different things. Start going swimming with them. Start playing a game, perhaps, after dinner or after school. Start creating an environment where there is safety enough to leave that phone alone. Or not safety, Joe, just an ease to leave the phone alone. But I think it's also important, you know, if you're going to give your child a phone, put some boundaries in from the get-go. Parental restrictions, talking about how often that child should be on the phone, making sure that you keep on top of that too. Yeah. Joe, would you mind if I asked you another question that's really pertinent at the moment for most families and most people I see? It's the issue of sleep.
Yeah.
And I wonder if you're noticing in your practice that there is a lot of people feeling a lot of issues around whether their child is sleeping or they themselves as adults are sleeping. Is that something you're encountering too, Joe?
Yeah, I think it's one of the questions I always ask, actually, with all the patients that I see. I ask them whether they are in difficulties with sleep, what time they sleep, especially the younger children when they're growing. And sleep is important because that's when you're growing. And whether they wake up during the night and then what time they're waking up. So it's always a question that I ask. And especially sometimes waking up in the middle of the night can be normal. And they soon get back to bed. The issue is when someone is sleeping very late and then they do fall off or they're falling asleep during the class at school. And so if obviously the child is not sleeping at night, they're going to be tired and they're not going to be able to concentrate at class. We all know sleep is very important. There's various optimum hours of sleep depending on age. And there's been various sleep studies done of looking at optimum hours. And as you get older, they sometimes say something like 7 hours. or 7.5 hours is the opt. You don't want to be sleeping too much, but you don't want to be sleeping too less. But sleep is very important, and especially in those younger years, early years, where growth is important, eating well, sleeping well. I think it sometimes comes in between both. So if you're not eating well, lots of sugars late at night is going to impact your sleep. If you're hungry and you've not eaten, then sleep is going to be affected. Sometimes it's medication can cause factors of sleep as well. So certain medication like ADHD can also impact sleep because they're stimulant medicines. Just like caffeine, drinking caffeine at night. I always remember a young boy who was 14 and he says, hey, I really struggle to sleep. And I'd ask him what he's doing, a food diary with him. And then you'd say, well, just before I go to sleep, I take a cup of coffee. So there's your answer of why someone is struggling to sleep. And the solution they want is, can I have a sleeping tablet of something? So again, what we always recommend is looking at why someone might not be sleeping, trying to find the solution to that. There are aids that can help. And so there are various things available in the NHS as well as privately, things like sleep hygiene, which looks at some of these things. There's various websites. Believe it or not, we talked about phones, but there's various apps that can actually help you also sleep. But again, you don't want to be hooked on an app from watching. But some of these sleep apps can also help with sleep. And then also, if need be, there are medication, things like melatonin. There's quick-release melatonin, prolonged-release melatonin, which can be given in the right under the right direction to support and get that child into that normal sleep pattern. And I think that's the important thing. You know, if there's other factors like stresses, anxiety, more and more anxiety. I'm sure, Emma, you probably see a lot of children with anxiety, which can affect their sleep. And so if you're not dealing with the issue, then those worries and stress, they're taking it to bed.
Yeah.
Like whether it's adults as well, it's breaking those habits, understanding those needs of what is the cause of why the child's not sleeping, rather than just giving a pill. Sometimes some people think you just give a tablet or something and we're not addressing the issue, but actually dealing with what we need to do and putting steps in. Because at some point, that sleep pattern will come back to normal.
We establish the routine.
Yeah. And then there's obviously various sleep therapists as well and sleep education. Have you got your phone there, by the way? I've been talking about that. There was a website that's now changed and it was called Sleep Scotland, and it's a really good sleep, and it's now called something Sleep Something Else, and it's a support for children and parents with sleep difficulties. I want to give the right name to it.
They would love to know that. Whatever that is, I would love to know it.
So we'll find the link and put it in the description about this sleep aid that's used for parents. And I think previously it was called Sleep Scotland, but it's been overtaken. It's got a new name. It's a really good resource for children and parents to help with sleep and sleep hygiene.
Nice. Joe, I wonder if I might ask you one final question.
That's good.
Over the course of your career, in the course of your experience, what stood out for you in terms of the work that you've done directly with children and families? What or who, I should say.
I think it's a mixture of a multitude of things. I feel very blessed to work with children. I'm very biased with what I do because I think for me, children are gifts from God, and kind of we have to do the best we can for the children. So I'm very child-focused, but I'm a big fan of preventive medicine. So giving them the tools that actually allow them to function, focus, and nurture for the future. And I think those things are really important for me. Added to that is the wonderful people that I've met across that journey. So whether it's parents, carers, healthcare professionals, therapists, wider team, I think that gives me the greatest joy and still satisfaction. Probably the best experience that I've had is the number of wonderful children I've met, parents and families. And sometimes we remember patients that have unfortunately passed away. Children, unfortunately, can get, like adults, cancers and various things. And unfortunately, some children will pass away very early. And you always remember the ones that have done. So sometimes it's a mixture of all those things that have really impacted the way I practice, but I always say feeling very much blessed by the children I work with, parents, carers, and fellow professionals.
It's lovely. Thank you, Joe.
Same question to you, Emma.
Oosh. Joe, I think like you, I'm shaped by my experience of the families I see and the professionals I work with and the networks. And as much as I would like to bring my knowledge and experience to families and we all learn something in that room together, I would say I take more from those families about learning about who I am in relation to them. And I think that has been the greatest pleasure of the job. You're always learning. And I guess like you, I have had people who stand out. And there was a young lad I was working with who was a looked after child. Lots and lots of things had happened in his life. And he kept going, Joe. He kept going. And you see these people pick their socks up day after day, wade through the stuff of life day after day, and they go forward, not back. And he trained as a horticulturist and ended up working at a national institute in the UK, growing plants.
Very good.
And I remember I saw him one day and he got something like 97-98% on his test at college. And it was Latin. He was naming the Latin names of plants. 97-98%, Joe.
Yeah.
And I think he just got a few letters wrong. That's all that happened, why he hadn't got 100%. And it's people like him that stand out for me and the greatest learning and the greatest joy there too. Thanks, Joe.
Emma, it's been a real pleasure having this conversation with you. I'd learned a lot during this session today as well. From my side, it's been really positive in sharing this experience. And hopefully some of the information that we've also talked about during this podcast is really going to help parents, family, patients. But it's been very valuable from my side.
Thanks to you, Joe. It's unscripted, right?
Yes.
So thank you. I've learned a lot too. Maybe we'll do some more.
Thanks, Joe.
Thank you.